Mini episode 1945 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You'll want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. It's yet another year of two of your favorite FDH Lounge original dignitaries, Rick Morris and Chris Galloway, getting together to do our division-by-division breakdowns of the NFL season. We start, as, of course, as always, with the AFC East. And what we will do in this segment is, this is the one where we're going to hit some macro-level issues from the offseason to coming into the season here. For the rest of them, we're just going to be looking at the divisional picture and the way that everything goes for that. But this being the first one that we do, it will be one where we get out some of the big headlines of the off season. And it's funny because a year ago at this time, we looked at it and it was just, you know, the season played out differently than we expected in a lot of ways, but just like a lot of continuation from one season to the next. Don't necessarily see that being the case this year, just because you had things like Kansas City missing the playoffs with Mahomes being down. That isn't necessarily anything that's going to repeat itself. And so there are some dynamics this year that look different than last year, which is how it goes a lot of the time. There's not as much apparent continuity from 25 into 26 as there was from 24 to 25. But if we're looking at it here, just one of the big things for the offseason, the connective tissue, I suppose, Chris, would be Vice. Yeah, in the notion of what the headlines have been about. Probably the dominant one throughout the course of the offseason is this scandal with Diana Russini and Mike Vrabel that ended up costing Russini her job at The Athletic. And for the Patriots, again, they weren't the normal team to go to the Super Bowl and lose. The Super Bowl hangover was never going to be different in the sense of like, oh, we were good enough to be there, but we just didn't win the last game. They really weren't. They were a fluke team on the easiest schedule in like a quarter century. So it goes to figure that, again, their Super Bowl hangover would be a little bit different than anybody else's. When you look at Tony Romo's DUI arrest, which ended up getting him off the air at CBS and possibly the glide path for J.J. Watt to become the number one color commentator going forward. Very recently, as we're taping here, Jed York, owner of the San Francisco 49ers, who is starring in his own private version of Trailer Park Boys. So there's all kinds of things, Chris, as we look at it here, that, again, Roger Goodell would probably prefer that we not be talking about.
I mean, actually, when you compare it to some previous NFL offseasons, Rick, it sounds actually pretty light.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, controversially speaking, right? I mean, we don't have any big systemic, you know, controversies, you know, like a deflate gate that indicts like an entire organization. We don't have, you know, some sort of labor strife issue. We have a bunch of individual failings, if you will. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I would even include Tony Romo in there. I mean, that's he's not part of the league anymore, or other than just being an announcer. Certainly not ideal for the league, but other than if it wasn't for Vrabel and Russini, this really would have been an uneventful, you know, off season as far as off seasons go for the league and the players. A few minor other stories that you didn't mention in there that I don't know that are worth it. You know, is, you know, the Rashee Rice saga, you know, gets done and some of the, you know, some of the other little side stories that are happening. But for the most part, other than the Vrabel-Russini story, I thought it was kind of quiet. Now, you're right, the whole Jed York thing, basically in the last 24 hours, blowing up is certainly a whole new one that we don't yet have a feel for. And you know, recently as well, the Deshaun Watson deciding to flame an entire fan base that's exacerbatingly, you know, stood by a franchise. So, you know, there's other, some other minor ones, but they're just pockets.
They are. And as far as, again, you're right about that. If not for Russini and Vrabel, it would have been a quieter offseason. But I'm sure Roger Goodell would reply to that. Other than the play, or other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln, as I step on the punchline here? But that is something where, again, it was sort of the defining storyline of the offseason. It was unprecedented as far as the way that these pictures and different things kept coming out. And I'm here to tell you, it ain't over with yet. I am predicting this, that whoever has been sitting on these things, I mean, could it be the eve of the season opener? You know, there's going to be any number of times when, try as they might, the announcers who again, are under the thumb of the NFL, who would love to not talk about these kind of things, will be forced to at various points going forward, I predict.
Well, they've done a very nice job up to this point of not wanting to talk about the Russini-Rabel thing. And I mean, let's all understand why they don't want to talk about it, right? Because it sheds a light on the whole insider concept. It sheds a light on the relationships, you know, both, you know, appropriate and inappropriate. And on the inappropriate end, it certainly sheds a lot of light. I mean, a lot of stuff has come out subsequently about other people, you know, and other coaches involved with Russini, and it sort of creates this sort of a Peyton Place type of environment where, you know, I don't want to say it's pay to play, but whatever the equivalency of that is, you know, in various hotel rooms. So not a great look, and I can understand why the other journalists don't want to discuss it. You know, I'm sure everyone involved there has their own sins to some degree, most of them of one ilk or another. You know, and so they aren't going to be quick to shine a light on anything or want to discuss it. It's a lot like if you remember when the Deshaun Watson allegations came out, and somebody, you know, some pointed out how none of the players were critical of him and his personal behavior. And I said at the time, Rick, you know, that's because a lot of them are doing the same thing. And it doesn't take much just to slink around Instagram and see what's going on there and how, you know, Deshaun was meeting these women. And you know, and if you believe that he was the only one engaged in such a thing, then I've got, you know, a series of bridges to sell you in Nebraska. And I think that's why players didn't have much to say about it. Because if they weren't doing it, they knew guys on their team that were, on every team. And so nobody wants to ever shed light on that sort of thing. And again, I think that's what happens with Russini and Vrabel. There's coaches that have, you know, cheated on their wives, or coaches that have slept with, you know, reporters and vice versa. And nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, yeah, and this is one of these things where when you look at various aspects of it, like the whole, I don't remember if it was video or still pictures that came out of those two getting the boat when she was heavily pregnant. So, you know, people are focusing on the prurient aspects of this, and understandably so, you know, and at the time of that thing, you know, you had a lot of people commenting on how he was going out there and, you know, allegedly tapping Mike Vrabel Jr. on the forehead during that boat trip and, you know, allegedly. But I'm here to tell you, I think that the prurient aspects of this are the less important side of it. And that is not generally the case whenever there's a scandal, because you have this insider media culture where, first of all, Adam Schefter, above all else, has sort of disproportionate influence in the league. Ian Rappaport as well. She was part of that hierarchy. You can probably throw one or two other folks in the mix. And the degree to which she was able to, again, allegedly, essentially use her power, warp her power to help out him and anybody else that was in her particular orbit, is that the tasteful way of saying it? That, to me, is the far bigger scandal than any of the sex stuff going on. It's the abuse of power, and it is the manipulation of the league landscape in ways that it is not supposed to be done by one of the prominent media partners of the league. Maybe not an official media partner of The Athletic, but you know what I mean. They're all in bed together, no pun intended, certainly. And that's one of these things where, again, if she's using her position to plant rumors and spread things and shoot down things and whatever that are basically warping the media landscape, and are being used for the benefit of Mike Vrabel and or whomever else was in her orbit, that to me is the real scandal, Chris.
Yeah, I don't know what the examples of that would be. I know she was the first to say the Patriots were interested in A.J. Brown, and obviously that came straight from the Vrabster, and she clearly had some other inside scoops when he was with the Titans. I don't know how it affected the landscape of the league. What I would be more concerned about if I was another coach or another franchise is, you know, did you have members of your front office or your coaches speak confidentially to her, right? Thinking that it would be off the record or confidential about a matter or maybe a player you might be interested in. So that, you know, just to give her a clue as to what the franchise is thinking. And then she reveals that to somebody like Vrabel, who can, you know, move on a player quicker in free agency, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that's the big thing. If you're another franchise, and sorry, I have the puppy dog here who's decided that I cannot be left alone.
Okay.
If you're another franchise, you know, that's what I'd be more concerned about, you know. Because, you know, when you talk about those journalistic standards, and you were, you know, you spent, you know, years as a sports journalist, you know that it's, you know, when you're speaking off the record or confidentially, you have to be, it's got to be like in the confessional, right? Like, you have to know that this reporter's not going to betray you. In the same way we hear the conversations about, like, well, Tom Brady's an owner for the Raiders, then how can he be in the TV conversation? Conversations with coaches before before the game was that week, because, you know, he may glean things about a team, you know, and their game plan and stuff that he could send back to his franchise. And I know that they've said, like, well, if he's doing a Raiders broadcast and someone's, you know, playing the Raiders, like, he won't be part of those meetings. And I'm like, big deal. I mean, does that mean he could meet with and glean things because he's a smart guy, that Tom Brady. He could meet with a franchise that's going to play with the Raiders 8 weeks later.
Right.
And glean things that he could pass along. So I think that's a bigger issue. And I think that's those are the things that probably concern people within the league more.
It could be. And again, in the case of Brady, you've got situations where even though he's not in there, you're looking at situations where his EP is going to be in there. That's executive producer, kids. So you're looking at staffers from Fox Sports that are going to be in there that are able to pass things along to him. So there's no real avoidance of that. To where you were saying where there may or may not be any real concrete areas where Diana Russini was able to warp the landscape for Vrabel. I do know that I had seen, it mentioned previously, that she was a voter for Coach of the Year. And I think Vrabel, I don't remember how it went, but he's been up for Coach of the Year in the course of the last couple of years. So that's a thing where, again, could be a real close deal there.
Minor thing. I mean, again, I don't think those coaches are going to really truly give a shit about that stuff.
It may not.
And everybody that votes in that, let's be honest, whether she's sleeping with him or she's not, every one of those voters has some sort of a bias, right? They might be a card, you know, poker buddy with McVay. They might be, you know, I mean, so they all walk in with these things with their own biases. You know, certainly it doesn't necessarily involve the bedroom, but, you know, right. I get your point, but I think the bigger concern, it really ends up being more about journalistic integrity and maintaining confidentiality when it's necessary. And, you know, I mean, look, she trashed her career. I don't know how she comes back from it, right? Like, it, right. That's part of the story. You know, she was making, what, $800,000-$900,000 a year, we learned,
right,
from the New York Times, you know, which owns The Athletic. That's a big salary. That's a lot of money to just flush down the toilet, and not to mention your reputation. And it's unfortunate because, you know, she made some lifestyle choices.
Well, but like, tell me your buddies over at Barstool wouldn't roll out a red carpet for her, though. You know what I mean? Like, depending on how much she's willing to embrace what happened to her, she can monetize this thing pretty easily, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they would. But, I mean, do you really want to go work for somebody like Barstool where you're kind of the butt of the joke? So you're kind of the shtick, you know? Like, what are they going to nickname you? What's your Barstool handle, you know? Call me daddy now. It's, you know, what is she like, you know, what are they going to call her? Like sports tramp? It's going to be like, I don't know.
They would. They absolutely wants, you know what I mean? Would.
You know, I don't know that they want that. I don't know that she wants that, right? Like, you know, these guys, you know, I don't know.
I mean, as tasteless as they are, I could see them doing something like, it's a run-through Thursday, and now we've got on Diana Russini for a football segment. I could see them being that tasteless, Chris. Absolutely.
Well, I can see them, but I'm just saying, I don't see why she would ever want to sign up for that. You know, because then she's
exactly
above the jokes, right? I mean, if you've got to try to go backwards, maybe print journalism for a few years.
Right.
Where you're not even on screen. I know that's hard and near to impossible to do in this day and age. If you want to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
But and again, who's talking to her with inside information at this point? Like, I think she's, you know, unfortunately, she's kind of wrecked herself. And,
yep.
You know.
Very much
anyway,
so, yeah.
We've already.
That was the biggest story in the offseason.
We've already given her way more time than she deserved on this podcast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Onward and upward with the football in the AFC East. And again, we'll remind everybody for subsequent divisions that if you want to hear the big picture offseason stuff, we just covered it here in the first part of the segment for the AFC East. The rest of the segment will be like just about all the other segments where we are focusing narrowly on that. And what we will do, we've used this as a format the last couple of years, and I know that you and I have agreed that it helps us to move through smoothly because there are so many different things that we could spend time talking about with each division. But from Fantasy Football Draftology 2026, available on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com, when you flip to the last two pages in the guide, it's one run-on sentence for each AFC team and one run-on sentence for each NFC team, penned by yours truly. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to use that as a basis of discussion for each division. And I'm going to take the teams in the order that I believe that they are going to finish. So here's what we have. We'll start in the AFC East with Buffalo. And as I said to Chris off air, not all of these are super run-on sentences, but the Buffalo one definitely is. Here we go. Buffalo. Deep breath. Notwithstanding an owner who impulsively fired his coach, by the way, at the exact moment that the owner's daughter was competing in her first round Australian Open match, thereby stepping on her big moment, admittedly purely because of laying eyes on a distraught Josh Allen in the locker room after the Denver playoff loss, and notwithstanding that same owner putting his number one wide receiver on blast at a diarrhea of the mouth press conference, and notwithstanding that same owner wanting a real change but settling in the end for promoting his offensive coordinator to head coach, and notwithstanding overpaying to get a dubious number two wide receiver, the Bills stand firmly atop the AFC East, albeit completely by default, as New England falls out of the playoff picture altogether, and the Jets and Dolphins both being a smelly pile of doo-doo. I guess that's a spoiler about the rest of the division. New England, an exponentially tougher schedule, plus an ongoing scandal with the head coach that keeps regenerating constantly in terms of providing toxic distractions, plus unaddressed needs on defense, equals a number of steps backwards all the way out of the playoffs, even with the A.J. Brown acquisition. A side note, I actually do think New England will be a better team than last year, but the fact that they're playing an actual NFL schedule this year, I think, is what's going to get them. Up next is Miami. Chris Greer's Swiss cheese roster is being swiftly overhauled, but that will take time. But the new coaching staff will have the team playing very hard, and Malik Willis is likely the QB that the team can build around over time. But the very achievable ceiling is still being the most competitive 4-13 team of all time. New York Jets, blatantly tanking with Geno Smith under center is a way of quote-unquote overcoming an improved roster. But with lame duck head coach Aaron Glenn pacing the sidelines, the franchise is firmly poised to be bad enough to land a flagship quarterback in the landmark 2027 NFL draft. So I have to believe, big picture, Chris, there's probably not a whole lot that you disagree with there. You may disagree with me, I think, perhaps somewhat on New England, but in terms of where I see the teams in the rest of the division, I'd be startled if there were too many things that you differed with.
Rick, I agree with your order. I'm gonna come in with the Bills to 12-5, and okay, winning the division, and I think they are going to be a better team. I think they are. I think you're seeing already this preseason that they are down to business as a squad. They are practicing hard. They are prepared. I like this. Bills team, like, I feels like they are hyper focused at this point. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think the Patriots could be a better squad, but take a step back in terms of record. I have them at 10-7. So, excuse me. I apologize. Goldenrod has begun here. so here come the fall allergies. But I see them as 10-7. Obviously, that's a step backwards. I don't think it's as big a fall as you have. I'm guessing you have them at like 9-8 and missing the
play. 8-9.
I think that's a little too negative.
Okay.
I think the core of this team is solid. They play a much tougher schedule. I think they find a way to win some games. I kind of played around with this, and I could, 9-8 was kind of where I was also tinkering, but I was going to give a little nod to Drake May and picking up A.J. Brown and figuring, okay, let's go 10-7, a step backwards, but they, you know, they're still a good competitive, you know, hard playing football team. I concur. I think, again, between the Dolphins and the complete teardown and the rebuild that's underway, I'm not as convinced on Malik Willis the way you are. By any stretch of the imagination. And I think the Dolphins are a 3-14 team. And I think the Jets are a woeful 2-15. And I think those two teams will be absolutely competing for pick number one in the NFL draft.
I think that those two teams are going to be bad enough that if they have a, just, it would be fitting, if they have a late season game, and I think that they do, it would be very fitting to have the ceremonial coin toss done by either Sashi Brown or Hugh Jackson, right? That's how bad those two teams are going to be.
Well, I think people are forgetting that, like, Geno Smith looked pretty good in a structured offense with great coaching and a much better squad of talent around him. He went to Las Vegas last year and looked like sheer dog doo-doo. I mean, mm-hmm. He's terrible. And I think that's the Geno Smith you're getting again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, the Jets are worse off in talent. They're worse off, you know, across the board. Maybe they're not quite as bad as the Raiders last year, but they, in terms of offensive talent. But he's going to be terrible. I mean, Geno Smith is the pick of, we're going to give a guy some money who's a veteran, but we also know he's going to lead us boldly to two wins. You know, like, yeah. this is going to be a bad, bad result for Jets fans this year. And as a Browns fan, for me to say I feel sorry for Jets fans, it's saying something, right? I mean, but
yeah,
at the end of the day, the difference between the Jets and, of course, the Browns, and we'll get to them later, is that, like, their franchise knows exactly exactly what their mission is this year, right?
It's
what they're doing.
And here's the thing, though, and I was about to bring up the Browns, too, because of the obvious kinship between the organizations and being, you know, joined at the hip in terms of ineptitude. But it's a thing where with the Jets, the Browns are bringing in Todd Monken, who could be a one and done based on what he's doing thus far. Like with the Jets bringing back Aaron Glenn, there's no percentage in it other than, I guess, Woody Johnson doesn't want to have to pay a head coach to do nothing. I mean, even if you bring in a coach and it's one and done before you get who you're really going to have with Arch Manning or whoever in 2027, this whole I don't get it. Like, you can tank without the poisonous culture of a holdover. That team was such that team was one of the most embarrassing failures in recent memory last year, like Browns level, right? Like, it's one thing to be a bad team. The Jets are rarely as embarrassing as they were last year. And you bring back the head coach, it just poisons things, the entire atmosphere for the season. Like, we know that they're going to be bad, but presumably the bulk of the players on this team and the young players are going to be back in 27. And you'd rather not have them tainted by another embarrassingly bad season this year. So that's what I question. This is like bad organizations making bad moves consistently. Like, it's like, if you're going to tank, you actually have to tank with as much dignity as possible. You have to try to convey to the locker room as much as possible, even though it's a lie, that you would like to win, as opposed to just like, screw it, guys. There's no pretense here. That's where the Jets are at, bringing Aaron Glenn back. There is no pretense.
I don't disagree with that, but, you know, I don't know that I agree with the idea of just a one and done intentionally. You know,
if a coach works fine, but like if he doesn't work fine, that's kind of how I look at it.
Well, my guess,
like an interim coach, if it doesn't work.
My guess is they didn't have the coach they wanted this year available. And so somebody made the decision that, like, let's just let it ride out another year. You know, and never discount the fact that there can be behind the scenes pressures from the league as well for firing, you know, an African American coach with such a focus on the Rooney rule and opportunities like Tomlin, of course, stepping away from the game. You know, you don't know what other pressures came on and said, "Boy, you can't do that. You know, stick it out another year." So I don't know. I don't necessarily disagree with you that it leads to a tough culture, but I also know that another year that versus then you bring in some young, sharp, dynamic coach, when you get the number one pick, you can turn that culture around overnight with young players, right? So I don't know that it has to grip the team beyond the season.
Well, we'll see about that. And on the whole thing of, like, who would they get to replace him? Like, I don't know. Look at what you got in the New York area, right? You got Fordham, you got Columbia. Like, none of these schools have a coach on their team. Like, I don't know the names of those guys, Chris, and I would take them over Aaron Glenn right now. So, I mean, just like,
I don't think the Jets were going to blatantly Ted Lasso and hire the Fordham women's soccer coach, right? I mean, say here.
Well, a football coach, Chris, not a football coach. I didn't go that far.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think to that end, you give him enough, you roll him back out there, and, you know, everybody knows what it is. The Jets will lose a couple games at the very beginning of the season, and anybody that's trying to believe or work hard or do whatever, it'll die. The culture in that, whatever spirit is in that locker room will die quickly. And then guys will just be trying to figure out how they put good film on tape so they can find a way off that team.
Yeah. And again, it's just, it's going to be another lost year for the Jets. Again, the precursor to, again, if the Jets don't Jets this thing, what could and should be better in 27, 28, and 29 going forward. The end of this era, if they've done it well, but when's the last time they've done it well? So we'll see how that goes. A year ago, I remember that I shocked the world by picking on New England to make the playoffs, and they did. And I believe you joined me in that. So that was a thing where, again, looking at it this year, with the record you're picking them for, are you picking them to go back? Because I'm not exactly shocking the world, but I might be startling the world somewhat in saying that I don't think they'll make the playoffs. What do you say?
If I got them at 10-7, then, so I think if they do make a wild card spot, if I settled on 9-8, I probably would have had them missing the playoffs.
Okay.
But I'm going to guess at 10-7, they sneak in with that last spot.
Okay.
I think there's going to be some better contenders. Again, last year with the Patriots, you and I, who would have guessed that level of success? We know the record. The schedule was weak, but I did believe even the sort of the Vrabel mystique in terms of coaching up a team, the sort of alpha male effect on the roster. And it proved to be the case. And then they got the greatest gift in the world with Bo Nix out with injury for the AFC Championship game. And it should have been the Broncos. He doesn't go down, it's the Broncos. Nobody believes outside of New England that the Patriots win that game had Nix not been lost. They got a gift. They got into the Super Bowl as a gift. I guess maybe there were some people that were taking them that game, but you and I certainly didn't.
I don't think there were too many people.
No. That game played out exactly how I expected it to play out. Especially if you'd watched the season unfold, you knew who the better team was, and it proved to be a very boring Super Bowl from that regard. But to their credit, they got there, right? We just talked about the Jets, and we've talked about the Dolphins, and we're going to talk about the Browns, and there's plenty of franchises that would love to just get them. Credit to them. I have them making the playoffs, Rick, at 10-7. They'll eke their way in, barely.
Okay.
I would expect a quick exit.
Yeah, I would agree that if they did make it, it would be. And I would just say, as far as anybody that was picking them in the Super Bowl, from what I remember, it was all the sort of knuckle dragging, like Sam Darnold, level commentary on that, as though we haven't seen elite level defenses, some of the greatest defenses of all time, carry quarterbacks that good or worse to Super Bowl titles. People were kind of forgetting that. So Sam Darnold coming in and being a perfectly cromulent quarterback in the Super Bowl, as he was in the playoffs, with an outstanding cast around him, was enough to get it done. And New England on a run where, again, you and I both agree that they take a step backwards this year before potentially moving forwards again after this. And again, we differ on the degree to which that will be the case. Looks like we broadly agree for the AFC East. We'll see how many more divisions that proves to be the case. Next up, it is going to be the AFC North. Look forward to breaking that down with you, buddy. Thank you so much, Chris Galloway, and thank you all for checking out our 2026 FDH Lounge AFC East Preview.